Please rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All manner of persons having anything to bring before the Honorable Justice of the Supreme Court of the State of Delaware will now draw near and give their attendance. The court is now open. God save the state and the Honorable Court.
Good morning. Court's ready to hear argument in Heritage Homes versus Alexander. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Morning, Mr. Walcott.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Your Honor, this case is a commercial case that involves the right of an owner and developer of a subdivision called Lexington Mill to control the building of the homes in the subdivision. They started the subdivision and have built all the homes there. And to do that, Heritage Homes provided in its contract that if the purchaser of the lot didn't build within a certain, didn't start construction in a certain period of time, then...
Oh, I thought that was the issue, the period of time.
The issue below was whether the contract violated the rule against perpetuities. And Vice Chancellor Noble found that it did. Based on the sort of theory that because it was he's construed it as an option, and when under the sort of the options in gross theory of rule against perpetuities, that every option, unless it is absolutely exercisable within the period of the rule, was void against the rule against perpetuities.
So how long did these people have? What's the number of years?
The number of years was the option vested within, if the construction didn't begin within 3 years, then the option vested in Heritage Homes. If the construction began in 3 years, then the option was void because of operation of the contract. So,
if they didn't build in 3 years, how long did Heritage Homes have?
Well, Heritage, the option at that point, they would give notice. There wasn't a specific time limit in the contract for the exercise of that option. And the court below found that because of that, the option violated the rule against perpetuities. But I think really the court should have construed the language as not an option, but rather as a possibility of reverter or a future interest conditioned on a subsequent condition, so that when in the 3 years what would happen is either the property would revert back to Heritage Homes automatically under the possibility of reverter, or Heritage Homes would give notice that there was a breach of the contract because the construction had not begun, and they would then be able to repurchase the property.
But there was nothing automatic under this language, was there?
Well, there would be if it were construed as either a possibility of reverter or as a condition subsequent, future interest subject to a condition subsequent.
But wouldn't that write out out of the contract the language about the seller giving notice?
No, I don't think so, because that would just provide for notice when the event of the transfer was to happen, so that you would give notice. For instance, if it were construed as a condition subsequent, then it would be subject to a statute of limitations, the 6-year statute of limitations or a 3-year statute of limitations for breach of contract, so that if you didn't, you would give notice, and then the seller, the purchaser, the Sartells would then deed the property back. It was just a notice provision where they had to be ready to deed the property back. So it's properly construed. The clause does not violate the rule against perpetuities, because the other two, the possibility of reverter or the future interest subject to a condition subsequent is not, neither of those violate the rule against perpetuities as a matter of law, because of the conditions that they present.
But the deed is in fee, though, isn't it?
The deed was in fee. The deed does not reference the condition of re-deeding, of deeding back the property if construction does not begin. That was in the contract of sale. It did not follow into the deed. But and you know, you have Mr. Howard argues that because of that, he doesn't argue, but the court didn't consider it below because they said it didn't need to, but the doctrine of merger, where if you have a contract and you have a deed and it doesn't go into, and whatever you were trying to enforce doesn't go into the deed, then it disappears because of the doctrine of merger. But I think in this case, that doctrine doesn't apply under several cases having to do with construction of houses where there are things that need to happen later on, and consequently it's not a merger problem. And Mr. Howard has argued that because this isn't in the deed, then it can't possibly be a possibility of reverter or a future interest having to do with the property, but it's not in the deed. But there's no, and he said he can't find any authority where it wasn't in a deed. And frankly, I couldn't find any Delaware authority either that said it didn't have to be in a deed. But logically, it doesn't have to be in the deed because the reason for the deed and the reason for recording the deed is not to make the sale of the property enforceable between the purchaser and the seller, but rather it's to make it enforceable against the world so that the purchaser has the legal title to the property. But they still have their contractual relationship between each other. And if they breach some condition of the contract, then they're liable. The defendant is liable to the plaintiff.
Let's assume Mr. Howard's client quietly gave a deed to somebody else and that your client didn't know, and they went to the recorder of deeds office and recorded it so that they had fee simple title. Your client, presumably under your theory, would have a cause of action for damages against Mr. Howard's client.
Yes, that's correct.
And who would have title?
The new purchaser would have title if they took it as a bona fide purchaser, because they would take it, they wouldn't be subject to some contractual relationship between Heritage Homes and Sartell and the Sartells if they didn't have notice of that. And that's kind of what happened in this case. The Heritage Homes filed suit and filed a Liz Pendens on the property, and then the Sartell said, we want to sell the property, and the Liz Pendens was then dismissed. And so the two lots have now been sold. And so, you know, the purchasers took with notice of everything, but because the Court of Chancery dismissed the Liz Pendens, they took free and clear, I think, of the restriction, so to speak, of the requirement to resell the property to Heritage Homes. And so that's why we have the claim is against the Sartells.
But is there any example of a contractual reverter that you've been able to find?
I have not been able to find an example. I looked through Gray's, Most everything is in deeds. And I think the reason for that is illustrated by the Bunting case. I mean, that case, if my memory serves me correct, the deed was done in 1858 or 1878, some time like that, and the litigation actually was in 1942. And if you're going to, you have a very long period of time between the time the restriction is placed on the property and when it actually comes to fruition that there might be a problem. And so you wouldn't want to have it in a deed if you're going to have a long-term restriction. Here we have a three-year restriction. If the construction doesn't begin within 3 years, then the restriction attaches. If they begin construction within 3 years, then they can continue on constructing for however long they want to, and Heritage Homes has no right at all because their right to get the property is extinguished.
This was a handwritten clause by lay people?
There are two clauses involved. The first clause is a typewritten clause in the Heritage Homes contract, which indicates that the, and I can point them out, Your Honor.
But I can find them. That's all right.
The typewritten clause is one that says that if there's no construction, then it will, they'll have the Heritage Homes will have the right to repurchase the property. The time limit, the 3-year time limit, was handwritten as an addendum in the sort of the real estate form contract. So the two together are how the contract is looked at.
But these were, is it in the record whether these were drafted by lawyers?
It is not in the record, but I can tell Your Honor what I understand to be the fact. The typed up contract, I believe, was drafted by a lawyer some years ago when the Lexington Mill subdivision was begun. There was also a set of restrictions that are part of the contract, and they're in the record, having to do with how Heritage Homes controls the subdivision. I mean, they have built all the houses on the subdivision. There are still some lots left that have not been sold, and they've built all the houses, and it's all very, very uniform with respect to the way it looks. And so they've tried over the years to maintain that control.
I was wanted to follow up on the possibility of reverter for a condition subsequent issue. How exactly would that operate under your theory? You know, let's assume 3 years go by and no construction has begun. When does the possibility of reverter end, if at all?
Well, I don't know that the possibility of reverter ever ends, because under a possibility of reverter, the reverter is automatic. And it may be that no one will ever come in and claim it, and I suppose at some point there'll be a latches argument, but theoretically what happens in a possibility of reverter is the title to the property reverts automatically back to the former fee owner.
Okay, but if you're saying that that's what this arrangement was, how would it automatically revert, and at what point in time would that happen? It seems as if there's nothing that's going to trigger that.
Well, I think it would be like the Bunting case, which I believe there were some interim years between the time the condition ended, you know, the school was not being used, and the people came in and actually tried to get the property, or in the Addy case where there was an abandonment by the U.S. government, and the former owners came in to try to get the property, and there was an ejectment action, I believe, and so it could happen at some later point, and the people who have the property would then be always subject to the true owner coming in and saying, that's my property.
The true owner being your client after 3 years, is that what you're saying?
If it had been in the deed and the new owners were bona fide purchasers, then I think it would not be, you know, they could not come in against the bona fide purchaser. But if there had been...
Let's assume the same people still own it who signed this contract. Are you saying that after 3 years your client is the owner of that property?
Under a possibility of reverter. And it would be an automatic reversion interest to the original owner, because the condition under which the new owners own the property had been breached. And so they would automatically get it. Under the future interest subject to a condition subsequent, it's essentially a breach of contract, and so there would be a breach. And if you didn't come in and for instance seek a decree of specific performance, then you would lose your right. And so there would be a limitation on that, depending on how the court would construe the clause, whether it be whichever one, the way it construed it.
How does that provide stable and predictable title if this is in a document that's outside the chain of title?
Well, I don't think it has any effect on the predictability of title if it's outside the chain of title, so long as the new purchaser doesn't have knowledge of it. Because I don't think that Heritage Homes can make a claim against the new owners, as Vice Chancellor Noble did in the decision. He gave Heritage Homes some time to bring in the new owners. I'm not sure how much that was considered, but I don't think you could really bring in the new owners, although they may have had some notice of it. I think that the real claim here is against the Sartells, because they have they have a personal contract with Heritage Homes.
So it's a possibility of reverter conditioned upon the same buyer owning the property.
If it had been in the deed, then say the condition had been actually in the deed, then and the Sartells then sold it to someone, then they would be subject to the reverter also.
But on the facts of this case, it's a possibility of reverter subject to the condition that the Sartells still own it at the time.
There would be a damage case. There could be a damage case against the Sartells for whatever damages Heritage Homes is able to prove. For instance, the failure to build a house, or the delay in doing that, or the any damages there might have been on the resale of the lot, for instance.
Was the contract for construction, those provisions, that would be void upon recording? What happened if somebody tried to record that?
The contract?
Yes.
Well, nobody did try. I don't know that the contract could be recorded because it's not acknowledged. Without it being acknowledged, I don't know that there could be a recording of the contract.
Well, was there language in there that it would be void upon recording?
No, there was not. Not that I'm aware of. I see my time is up. I'm not sure whether my 2 minutes left is for rebuttal
No, you're using your rebuttal time right
okay.
now.
Okay. Well, I will then end. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Howard.
Good morning, Your Honors. Eric Howard on behalf of the appellees. Your Honors, I wanted to touch briefly. I know that isn't the issue that you spoke most with Mr. Walcott concerning, but we believe that to get to this issue of whether it violates a rule against perpetuities, or if it's a possibility of a reverter or a future interest subject to a condition subsequent, all is issue you have to wrestle with only if you were to find that there is an enforceable contract to build a house at the back end. Which we do not believe there was, in which Vice Chancellor Noble found in his decision. There's this contract, they call it a contract, or they call it an agreement, but we submit it's not a contract. It provides that the parties intend to attempt to reach agreement to construct a house of 3,000 square feet at
now,
a price.
Mr. Howard, is this argument independent of the merger argument or part of the merger argument?
It's independent, Your Honor. We believe.
So you're saying even if it had been incorporated by reference into the deed and expressly said whatever this is survives the execution and delivery of the deed, you would be able to argue whatever this was is unenforceable for vagueness or whatever you're going to tell us about now.
That's correct, Your Honor, because the appellants cannot prove damages. It's fundamentally have to have a claim. You have to have a claim for damages, and the cases cited in our briefs, both before Vice Chancellor Noble and before the court, make clear that you can't agree to agree, you can't impose reasonableness standards and say, well, we think that would be reasonable. That's what the party should have agreed to. We'll make that the term. The court just can't do that. And a covenant of good faith and fair dealing can't insert material terms that are not in an agreement. And again, based on the case law, we do not believe that that was an enforceable agreement. Mr. Walcott argues that you can extrapolate from other contracts that we've done in the past and figure out what our costs were. But again, you're extrapolating, assuming that the Sartells would have agreed to those and that they would have agreed to what the specs were, what the exact size of the house would have been. All those things are just completely speculative as to what an agreement would have been. So I do want to turn back now to what the court seemed to be most interested in, the issue about the rule against perpetuities. But I just believe that you don't need to get there because, in any event, there's no provable damage claim. Your Honor, on this possibility of reverter, we believe that that's clearly what this is not. If you're to do anything, you can determine that that is not a possibility of reverter. Every case that I've been able to locate, including the Bunning, Lynch-Bunning case and the Addy Short case, in the other cases I've seen, the deeds itself contain, not only is the language itself in the deeds, but it's definitive language. It says, we're deeding, it's a qualification of the conveyance of a fee simple interest. It says, we're conveying you this land so long as it's used for a school, or until it stops to be used for a railroad, or there's limitation language in the grant itself that is automatic. And the only thing that has to happen, there's no affirmative, we want to take title or not. It's just the only question is someone going to file a suit to enforce it, to say you don't own the property anymore, the reverter has occurred. So there's no action that has to happen on the face of the deed. It's clear that the title ended, the conveyance ended, when the purpose for which the property was conveyed stops. So if anything, I think you can rule out the possibility that it is a possibility of reverter. We believe that it is an option agreement that violated the rule against perpetuities. And
so you're saying no matter how it's constructed, how it's written, it's a legal impossibility to construct a possibility of reverter independent of the deed itself?
Yes, Your Honor. And also just the language that was used, even if you look to the contract in this case.
Now, is that based upon the fact that you found no case that's addressed that, or there's some authority that says reverters must be in a deed to be valid?
I have not found a case that says they have to be in the deed. But the language that was used, even in the contract, if you were to say that that contract survives, and notwithstanding that it is it wasn't in the deed, it survived notwithstanding any doctrine of merger, the language doesn't say we're conveying this property to the Sartells so long as they contract with Heritage Homes to build a house on it, or it's being conveyed to the Sartells until 3 years from now, and if they haven't conveyed a house on, built a house on the property 3 years from now, it's ours again. The contract doesn't say that kind of on its face limiting language to the absolute interest that was conveyed to the Sartells. So it's not necessarily the fact that it's not in the deed. It's just the lack of the finality or solemnity of the language used. It's drafted as an option. No matter what you want to call it, it's drafted as an option agreement, not as a your title ends when you haven't built a house on the property in 3 years. So on the rule against perpetuities, the appellants argue that the Pathmark case is the one that they really controls, and that the court had ought to recognize that and reverse Vice Chancellor Noble's decision. In the Pathmark case, though, it was one clearly differentiating circumstance, and that was that there was a definitive time period. It was a 20-year option. I might be mistaken. I apologize. I believe it was a 20-year option, but there was a definite time period within which the option had to be exercised. In this case, there isn't one. It just says that you have, if the Sartells haven't commenced construction within the it doesn't even say if the Sartells haven't commenced construction, they will convey the property back to Heritage Homes on 30 days notice. I have not been able to. Mr. Walcott says, well, the statute of limitations imposes a time limit on that. I have, as soon as you say there isn't a case out there that allows you to do that, there is one, but I have not been able to locate a case that says that you can fill in the gap of a missing time period on an option that on its face appears to violate the rule against perpetuities by saying, well, the statute of limitation imposes a time frame. In fact, in this case, the actions of Heritage Homes seem to refute their own contention. It's all in the record before the court, but in February of 1988, just months after the Sartells had purchased the property, they said, we've changed our mind. We don't want to buy we don't want to build on the house. Buy it back from us. We don't want to build on the lot. Our plans have changed. Buy it back from us. And the Heritage Homes waits 4 years. It's not until July of 2002 that it says we're exercising our option now. So even under Heritage Homes' interpretation of the agreement, they didn't think that they were bound to purchase the property back on some kind of time frame that was triggered, because in any event, the Sartells telling the Heritage Homes that we're not going to build on that property was an anticipatory repudiation of the contract. So if you're going to say a statute started running or a time period that you could exercise that option started running, that's when it started. And yet they waited for 4 years, over 4 years, before they even said that we're going to purchase the property. So, again, I think the more analogous case is the Kingston case where the court said this is an open-ended option by a corporation of perpetual existence. It violates the rule against perpetuities. I did not argue below, and I didn't argue in the briefs here, that the doctrine of merger makes this case go away. Because I don't think it does. In fairness, the cases out there indicate that if merger is a doctrine, as I understand it, has been increasingly contracted to what it applies. And if it appears that the parties, by their conduct, intended specific provisions to survive closing, the fact that it isn't in the deed isn't the end-all of the matter. But it is significant, we believe, in this case, that it wasn't in the deeds, because Mr. Walcott's argument is that we're creating interest in land. You know, we're creating a future interest subject to a condition subsequent. And to the extent you argue that we're creating a future interest in land and you don't spell it out with specificity in the deeds conveying that interest, exactly what it is you're purporting to be creating, it fits into the mix that, is that really what this is? Are we really trying to go through a lot of hoops to make this fit into something that it isn't? When if you had intended that to be a future interest with a condition subsequent, it really should have been in your deed.
Do you recall if the contract says it's void upon recording or not?
It definitely doesn't. Well, it's my best recollection, without spending another minute looking through it line by line, it does not say that. And it could have been recorded. You could have recorded a memorandum of agreement also. So if they were concerned with making that a matter of record, I submit their ways that could have happened.
But all of those would have had to be notarized.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
So that's, Mr. Walcott said this contract wasn't notarized.
It was not. It was not.
That ends the question about recording this contract, doesn't it?
Well, you could have recorded a memorandum of agreement. I believe you could have recorded an ex parte memorandum of agreement saying that there was an agreement and one party could have signed it and notarized it and filed it.
So like a Liz Pendence, you're creating a document with a notary clause on it and you're making an attachment that puts people on notice there's a dispute.
Yes, Your Honor. I think you could have done that. Mr. Walcott argued that what we're really trying to do is protect a developer's right to control the type of houses that are in the development. And as I said in our briefs, we have never contended that the restrictive covenants did not apply. They were of record when my clients took the property. They're of record today. And whoever builds in there is going to have Heritage Homes approve their plans before they can commence construction and their legal remedies if they don't.
But it's not unusual now to have tie-ins where you buy a package around the state from a developer builder.
Right? It's not, Your Honor. I've written those. But what you do is you write a contract that says the land price is X dollars and we're going to negotiate a contract for the construction of the house. And if we are unsuccessful in doing that, we never close on the land. The whole problem here is that for whatever reason, the parties wanted to close on the land, and that's not in the record, and you can speculate as to why that happened. But they closed on the land without an agreement to construct the house. I do not argue, and we have not argued, that a tie-in is per se illegal. It happens, and they're the owner of the property, and they want to say that we aren't conveying this lot to you unless we enter into a contract with you to build a house. You could do that, and it's done all the time. This whole problem could have been avoided had you just entered into a contract and say, "Here we have 6 months to come to an agreement on the construction of a house. And if we can't come to that agreement, we're not conveying the lot to you, and the contract's void, and take your deposit back, and we go on our ways." And that happens, and respectfully, that should have happened here. And it's because of that didn't happen, we have the mess we have and a contract that violates the rule against perpetuities.
So this case is an aberration then?
I think so, Your Honor. It's one of those where you wish. To my knowledge, an attorney did not have any say or any part of drafting the agreement of sale that had handwritten provisions in it. I believe Mr. Walcott is correct that the forum contract that's titled Construction Agreement, Construction and Land Sale Agreement, was written at some point by an attorney who I don't think had anything to do with filling in the blanks when it came time to sign it. I don't believe that this is any great precedent. I mean, there's a risk of any precedential effect because this really shouldn't have happened this way, and that's why we have the mess we have. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
I just have a couple of comments. The first is on the enforceability of the contract. The Vice Chancellor held that it was not because of the sort of vague, because what he thought was the vague nature of the sort of future construction. But there are a number of houses in the development. There was a square footage. There was there were other things, and the Heritage Homes didn't have an opportunity to present its proof at the trial. And I think there are some material facts that would be in dispute regarding how extensive the discussions were as to what was going to be done. But none of that was presented to the court below. So I think it would be premature for the court to hold that the everything else is moot because we couldn't decide what was going to be constructed. And in any event, that wouldn't make void for vagueness, if you will, the rest of the contract. I mean, certainly they still had to construct. That's not ambiguous. They had to start construction within 3 years. The statute of limitations argument is not one that we make with respect to the rule against perpetuities. Rather, it's one that we suggested that put a limitation, at least in terms of years, on the on the condition subsequent idea, that there was some limitation on that. It wouldn't go forever. The possibility of reverter, of course, would revert immediately. The other one would be a breach of contract, which would then be enforceable. With respect to the issue of whether all this has to be in a deed, interest in land only need to be in writing. They don't need, you can have an interest in land that's outside of a deed. The only reason for the deed is notice to the world and the race to the courthouse, which is our statutory scheme for protecting your property interests in land. So unless the court has further questions, that'll conclude my remarks. Thank you.
Thank you. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.
Please rise.